Earlier this year, the city of Providence, Rhode Island, fired all of its nearly 2,000 teachers. The district shut down 5 schools. In the end, most of the teachers were hired back. Some 400, though, were left without positions. To find them jobs, school officials are using speed dating. Elizabeth Harrison from member station WRNI reports.
Dozens of teachers lined up in a middle school gym, waiting for their chance to speak with principals who have openings on their staffs. Margaret Medoyan brought a tote bag stuffed with student work and lesson plans from her 30 years as an elementary school teacher.
I had to go through albums and albums and students' work, and I had to collect it. I put it in binders, and it took me maybe about 6 weeks to compile everything on my own time.
Some 400 Providence teachers are vying for fewer than 300 positions. Most of them were displaced simply because they work at a school that was chosen for closure. At the end of one line, Principal Carolyn Johnston meets a special education teacher.
Hi, how are you?
I'm Ian Charles. I'm elementary ed and special ed.
Why don't you sign in first?
Okay.
Sure.
This teacher will have just a few minutes to try to make an impression, then it's on to the next interview. Sixth grade teacher Ed German says it seems unfair that his future employment hinges on such a brief meeting.
What's been going on has been demeaning to my profession. It hurts, and I think it's sad.
Demeaning teachers is not what school officials say they are trying to do. Providence Public Schools spokeswoman Christina O'Reilly says the goal was to put all of the displaced teachers on an even playing field and give principals a chance to find a good fit.
We certainly recognize that teachers are not interchangeable. They're not widgets, they're people and they're professionals. And doing this sort of an open match hiring process gave a chance for each teacher to make their best case about their own professional credentials to a principal who's looking for someone to fill a position.
Teachers had a chance to browse openings before the job fair. The teachers and principals will rank their top choices, and a computer program will try to match everyone accordingly.
Fortunately, very little of this will be manual.
Carlton Jones is chief operating officer for the Providence School District. He says the process was designed to fill a large number of vacancies in a short amount of time.
And the goal is to have mutual consent so that principals are receiving teachers that they have consented to, and you don't get people going, I ended up where I didn't wish to end up, and be ready for school to open in September.
School officials see this as a compromise. The teachers do not have to compete with candidates from outside the district. But many Providence teachers have deep misgivings. They say none of this addresses real problems, like how to get rid of bad teachers or how to reverse a long history of low test scores for thousands of students in this urban school district. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Harrison in Providence.
You're listening to NPR News.
There's a special kind of tourniquet in use by the U.S. military in Afghanistan. It's called a combat action tourniquet, and it's standard issue to every Marine and U.S. service member. It's got a black plastic cinch that you pull to tighten, and it allows troops in Afghanistan to go out on foot patrol with the tourniquet already loosely strapped around their thighs so it can be tightened quickly if an arm or a foot is blown off. That tourniquet wasn't around in Vietnam, and now it's saving lives, lots of them. It's changes like these that Dr. Ronald Glasser details in his new book. It's called Broken Bodies, Shattered Minds, A Medical Odyssey from Vietnam to Afghanistan. Dr. Glasser joins us now from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. And a warning to listeners, the topics in this book are graphic. Welcome, Dr. Glasser.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Thanks for being with us. So a lot of this book, Dr. Glasser, is looking at how battlefield medicine has changed over time. You were an Army doctor during the Vietnam War. What was it like then? Describe what that work was like.
There have been enormous changes, of course. I mean, in Vietnam, the comment was, if you keep going back, sooner or later they'll kill you. And in Afghanistan and Iraq, the comment is, if you keep going back, sooner or later you'll be brain damaged. The difference is that in Vietnam you were shot, and in Afghanistan you're being blown up. But, you know, you mentioned about the combat action tourniquets. Well, the Marines don't like it. I mean, the officers view it as a kind of defeatism on the part of the troops.
How so? That they have to be prepared for these things?
Yeah, I mean, you put it on and it's because you're going to get blown up. But the Marines don't care. I mean, they understand. They just said that basically to hell with it. We're going to wear it anyway. If our legs get blown off, at least we'll survive. And that's one of the big, of course, differences is that every war has its own weapons, every war has its own strategies, and every war has its own injuries. And in Afghanistan, it's being blown up.
You also write about the complexities of those injuries. You can lose legs when you walk over a landmine or an IED goes off in your path. But some of these injuries are very personal injuries that the military isn't likely to really be public about. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, but nobody expected these injuries. I mean, the reason the armor really protects you from bullets or shrapnel or whatever, you know, from the back, side, and front. So when you get your leg blown off, the chances are that you're going to have a genital injury. The understanding of this throughout the military is quite substantial. There are informal recommendations now to the troops being sent to Afghanistan and Iraq, the male troops, that they should store their sperm. Now, the Army doesn't recommend it, nor does the Army like having anybody even hear about it. But, you know, our Army is not made up of fools, and it is a reasonable precaution to take.
You write extensively in the book about how these wars are characterized by these invisible injuries, post-traumatic stress disorder, or traumatic brain injuries. And it's interesting how you chronicle how that language has changed over time. I mean, in previous wars, this kind of acknowledgement of these injuries, they were called things like shell shock, combat exhaustion, combat stress.
Yeah, it's been there forever. In our Civil War, it was called melancholia at the beginning, you know, this desire for home. And then it became the irritable heart because these soldiers were shaking. And we had it in our Second World War. When at that time, it was beginning to be called combat neurosis. But this is PTSD. The one great success of medicine in Afghanistan is the realization and the connection between traumatic brain injuries, concussive injuries, and PTSD, showing that there is damage to the brain if you've had a concussive injury.
How has an acknowledgement that PTSD exists, that there are long-term psychological wounds associated with combat, how has that changed battlefield medicine? How has it changed the work of the medic on the ground?
Well, I mean, the importance of Afghanistan and Iraq is the new technology, in essence, the tensor MRIs. I mean, you get a mild concussive head injury, whether you're playing football and hitting your helmets together. And there's data from North Carolina State that if you play college football, you're going to hit your head 900 times in your 4 years of playing football. The NFL, of course, is that's a major concern that they have. Well, they're worrying about people hitting their helmets together. I mean, there are Marines. I mean, there are deployments, three or four deployments, where everybody has been exposed to an IED. And it's a misnomer. I mean, if you wire together 355-millimeter shells, put them in the ground, put some Centex on top of it, and a butane canister, it'll turn over a 60-ton M1A1 tank. It's hardly improvised. The heat within 5-10 meters of the blast is like 7,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The blast wave is 4 to 800 atmospheric pressures. It travels at 14,000 feet per second. And if you're standing 20 meters away from it, you're going to get your head rattled.
Wondering if you think medics today are more likely to recognize their own psychological scarring as a result of their deployment?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's tough. I've always admired the military. I mean, where else in our country are you going to learn as an adolescent or even as a young adult that when somebody tells you to do something, they expect you to do it, that the person next to you is as important as you are? There's a nobility there that is astonishing. And I think they all know this, but it's still tough to admit that you can't sleep at night. It's tough to admit that when a car backfires, you really get scared. But the advances being made in the connection between psychological injuries, in essence, diseases of the mind and damage to the brain, has been narrowed because of Afghanistan.
Ronald Glasser, he's a doctor and former military physician. His new book is called Broken Bodies, Shattered Minds, A Medical Odyssey from Vietnam to Afghanistan. He joined us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Dr. Glasser, thanks so much for being with us.
Rachel, thanks.
Throughout the spring, U.S. farmers faced floods, tornadoes, downpours, and droughts, everything but locusts. All of that bad weather made planting difficult. Now in June, intense heat has been sweeping over much of the country. The wild weather has been helping drive up food prices. This past week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said the delay in spring planting could reduce the size of the fall corn harvest. Here to talk about the anxiety growing from farm to table is NPR's Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax. Welcome, Marilyn.
Hi, Jackie.
So what's the USDA saying about this year's corn crop?
Agriculture officials started the year being pretty optimistic about how much corn American farmers would be able to produce this year. But then so much of the country got hit with that horrible weather in April and May. You remember those violent storms. We had persistent rains. It was especially bad for Midwestern farmers because, you know, they really need to get that crop into the ground by mid-May. Of course, the weather could turn around. It's weather. It could be perfect going forward, and that would help turn around these prices. But right now, most people are betting that corn supplies will end up being really tight this year. And that would be very discouraging news because, you know, we've already seen corn prices shoot up so much. The cash price of a bushel is around $7.75 right now, and it was $3.30 last year. So analysts are worried. They think the prices could go as high as even $9 a bushel.
That's a huge jump and even more consumer pressure. Where exactly will consumers see the rise?
Well, think about it this way. The farmers have to purchase corn to feed their livestock, and if they have to pay more for that feed, then consumers are going to have to pay more for their meat. Economists are predicting that meat prices are going to go up about 7% this year, and we've already seen the average price per pound of beef rise about 8% from last year. Of course, it isn't just the meat that's going up. A few days ago, the American Farm Bureau Federation released its Spring Market Basket Survey. It looks at 16 common food items that are purchased at supermarkets. It found that on average, the prices were 8% higher than 1 year ago. So a lot of food companies, Kraft, Kellogg's, Sara Lee, Smucker, they've all been raising prices to keep up with this surge in the price of their ingredients, the corn, the oats, the coffee, and so on. And we're starting to see it at restaurants, too. Even McDonald's has raised its prices.
With prices already being higher, Marilyn, this is obviously about more than just this spring's horrible weather, bad as it was and devastating as it's been.
Yes, that's right. The trend towards higher prices, that's been in place for months now. And, of course, it's a global phenomenon. The United Nations had a report out last week that showed that global food prices have been unusually high this year. The UN's global price index for meat actually hit a record high in May. The UN is blaming bad weather, but lots of other factors too. High oil prices, the catastrophe in Japan, export policies. But really, the biggest factor is this soaring demand. The world is just getting more crowded, and supplies aren't keeping up with the pace.
You know, Marilyn, being from an agricultural area, or at least it was when I was growing up, you always wonder what can be done besides hoping for rain or hoping rain stops.
Well, later this month, there will be a gathering of the agriculture ministers of the so-called G20. That's a group of the world's largest countries, and it includes the United States. So Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, he'll be there. And these top officials are getting together because they're so worried about rising prices and these lean inventories. They want to launch an initiative called the Agriculture Market Information System. This system would push countries to more honestly report about what's happening with their farmers. For example, China's always tended to be secretive about its food stocks. So if China were to sign on, it would release more data about its food inventories and its consumption.
And what exactly would that sort of transparency do?
The ag ministers say that transparency is important. If everyone had a better idea of what crops were being planted and how they were coming along, then the officials really could respond more quickly and in a coordinated way whenever they see food shortages developing. And more crop information, of course, would help cut down on some of that price speculation.
Well, Marilyn, what an interesting report. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing.
Oh, you're welcome. It was fun to be here, Jackie.
I met James Nave for the first time 25 years ago while working on a story for NPR. He was a whirlwind of energy, performing poems out loud in grade schools in his hometown of Asheville, North Carolina. He went on to perform poetry all over the world, from La Paz to Paris to the Philippines. For Nave, it was all about poetry and travel and freedom and creativity. He co-founded workshops like the Imaginative Storm Writing Salon. And then, wham, he made an all-too-common midlife discovery. He had health issues, prostate cancer, the big memento mori. He confronted the disease the best way he knew how, with words, vowing to write a poem a day for the 100 days following surgery. James Nave joins us now from our bureau in New York. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jackie. Good to be here.
You know, I really love reading your poems on your website and on Facebook, and it was like peeking into a diary of your recovery, but I kept thinking to myself, why is he doing this, setting himself up this chore from the get-go?
What happened was April 1st rolled around, which was the first day after surgery, and it was also Poetry Month. And poets around the country write 30 poems in 30 days. So I thought, well, what else do I have to do? I'm here in the hospital room, nowhere to go, so why not write a poem? So I wrote the first one, the second one, the third one. And then after I arrived at 15, I thought, why not go to 100? And I was starting to see themes emerge even in the first 15 poems. So I thought, I have to track this all the way through to 100.
I wouldn't say your recovery looked fun, but it did look interesting.
Well, it was, on some level, it was fun in the sense that things were changing all the time and my identity was changing. And I woke up from the surgery in this space that I'd never been in before. So I told somebody it was like going on a really nice vacation and all I had to do was climb Everest.
Can we hear the poem, Sunday, April 7th, I Had to Look? You were recovering at some friend's home in the Carolinas.
This morning by the Carolina mountainside, I climbed down my spine, one bone at a time, into unfamiliar territory. I saw veins, arteries, cells, blood, connective tissue, nerves, heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, and bladder. As I descended, I realized I was in a rainforest filled with things I didn't expect to see. Iguanas, bats, lizards, snakes, scaly-tailed squirrels, fairy bluebirds and butterflies, beautiful, graceful, complicated butterflies. I'd never imagined millions of butterflies were free inside my body. A purple one landed on a bush, then another, red with pink dots, then another, big brown eyes. I arrived at my pelvis, stood between my hips. I thought, I'd been attacked by blades and fingers. As I surveyed the cavernous territory, I saw repair. Nothing to weep about here, I thought. With that, I climbed my spine, one bone at a time. This afternoon, my surgeon called. He said my margins were clear. The cancer had not spread.
Can you talk to us a little about your prostate cancer and what effect it's had on you and why you're eager to talk about it?
I'm not sure exactly when I first realized, maybe it was 2 or 3 days after the surgery, that this was a permanent change and that I was going to have to do something to adjust to it, and I was going to have to be very active in that. So I think that's one of the things that propelled me with these poems.
What about the question of virility? I mean, that's something that is really important to human beings of both sexes.
Well, it's true. And I've been as vital a male as anybody could be. Even so, having this change, which basically, when you have your prostate removed, it alters the way you think sexually. It's certainly a little more refined, and it's more creative, and I'm responding to women in more open ways than I responded in the past, and it's much more creative.
When's your 100th poem due?
I think my 100th poem is coming up on July the 9th.
Well, we wish you all good luck with that.
Thank you so much, Jackie. It's been a real pleasure to be here and talk about this a bit.
And to be with you, and you have a good prognosis, right?
I do. It's great, actually. I have to be very careful with my health and pay attention, but the cancer's gone and everything looks like it's going to be fine.
Well, thanks again for spending the time. My friend, the poet James Nave. For more of Nave's poems, go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/NPR Weekend.
The Dallas Mavericks are one win away from their first NBA championship ever. And if that happens tonight, it would be a huge disappointment for the Miami Heat, who've been touted as the team to beat for the last year. NPR's Mike Pesca is our man in Miami for Game 6 and Game 7, if there is a Game 7. He's with me now. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
So the Heat have their backs against the wall at this point. We didn't really expect this, did we? The collective we?
Yeah, I think that before the season, like you said, people were just penciling them into the championship already. And that's ridiculous because even though they have the three great players in LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh, there's more to a basketball team than three players. And people were saying, oh, you know, Rachel, you and I could play on that team. And even though you have that sweet jump shot, no, that wouldn't work. We wouldn't be a very good team. So as the season went on, the Heat weren't good, and then they were good. And then it seemed, well, maybe the Heat will become this fait accompli. The Mavericks have had a lot to say about that.
So if the Mavericks win, would this be a Maverick success or would it be a Heat collapse?
That's the exact argument that sports fans are having and are really happy to have because it's been mythic. It's been mythic not in the sense that these guys really are heroes or superheroes, but it's been mythic in the storylines, the tropes of what defines mythology. I mean, here you have the Heat, and they were seemingly insurmountable, and the Mavericks were built as a team. They have a great player in Dirk Nowitzki, but they're much more of a team. And because it's so mythic, every time that the Mavericks do well, it seems a little bit like dragon slaying. And what we do is we take these Miami Heat losses, and we talk about character. Everything that LeBron James doesn't do is reported as a referendum on the guy's character. So right now, down 3-2 with his back against the wall, which is exactly how you want the myth to play out, LeBron James has to sort of assert himself as a person, we're saying, rather than just a basketball player. I mean, he's as scrutinized as anyone in the world of sports. So when I look at LeBron James and I look at what he's up against, I mostly see a guy whose task isn't as easy as it seems. And now, we haven't really talked about the Mavericks at all. All they are is the obstacle to
LeBron's. The Mavericks. Yeah. But come on, they're a big part of this.
We
should pay attention to them.
Right. And, you know, Dirk Nowitzki himself, he's unbelievably important to the team. He does take a lot of shots. Sometimes taking a lot of shots is criticized as being selfish. When LeBron James takes too few shots, he's criticized as being passive. I think I figured out what explains it, and it's if the shots go in. And Dirk's are going in, and LeBron's aren't, although more to the point, he's simply not taking them to the satisfaction of people who want him to step up and assert himself.
Okay, so it's your job to be impartial as NPR's sports correspondent. You are going to be at this game. You have just given us a very rigorous defense of LeBron James. Is it fair to say that you will be pulling for the Heat?
No. I root for the story, and it'll be fascinating to see how the story shakes out. I don't root for one story or the other. So if LeBron wins, the story is not complete. We got to go to a Game 7. Maybe I'm rooting for that. But, you know, if the Mavericks win, it will be this question hanging over everything that LeBron James does. Even if LeBron James scores 45 points, but the Mavericks still win, people will fairly, I think, criticize the game he had in Game 4 and the game he had Thursday night. And also, let me say that my defense of LeBron James was a defense of the conceptualization of LeBron James. If you want to hate LeBron James, that's fine.
I'm allowed to? Okay.
Yeah, that's what makes sports fun. I find it useful to sort of raise the other side of those issues.
Fair enough.
And to say that what you're talking about in terms of shrinking from pressure can be seen in a lot of other ways, like being unselfish. But you know what? It all becomes part of the story.
Moral lessons from NPR's Mike Pesca. Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome.